Hi, everyone. I'm Chris Aldana, and this is the National Education Policy Center's Talks Education Podcast. This month, we're speaking with Dr. Sonia Douglas about racial justice in K-12 public schools. Dr. Douglas is a professor of education leadership at Teachers College, Columbia University. In her work, she examines the problem of racial inequality in K-12 schools and how race is conceptualized and understood by leaders for equity and social justice in the U.S. She's particularly interested in how education leaders come to know race within equity, diversity, and inclusion discourses, and how this knowledge informs and is informed by their leadership ideologies, epistemologies, and practices. She's the founding director of the Black Education Research Collective and the co-director of the Urban Education Leaders Program. In this month's episode, Dr. Douglas walks us through where schools stand in efforts and capacity to promote racial justice in the aftermath of the COVID-19 pandemic, describing some research she's led through the Black Education Research Collective to support Black students in schools in New York and beyond. So we're 2.5 years removed from the start of the pandemic and the murder of George Floyd. So looking at K-12 schools, what's your sense of where schools stand in being able to face the challenges that are coming up in the future? So if you think about things like declining enrollment or the continued obstacles that we're going to face with the pandemic and systemic racism.
Well, thank you for the question. I think we are at a pivotal moment in many ways. And so our decisions and the decisions that we make now can really determine the trajectory of public education in particular going forward. I think that it is time to continue to advance an agenda where we support and invest in teachers and in leaders and in the preparation of teachers and leaders who are culturally relevant and responsive and have the capacity to support students and meet them where they are. I also think it invites an opportunity to talk about what should be taught in schools, which is happening to some extent in ways that could be more productive in terms of the history that we teach, the topics, the way that we teach students. So it's really an opportunity for major transformation. And I think to begin to implement many of the ideas that educational researchers and scholars committed to equity and justice have been really advocating for over the last several decades.
Do you think we're in a better position today than we were, or to go forward with the approach that you just described? Are we in a better position today than we were 2 years ago?
It's hard to say if it's a better position. I think there's certain aspects of it that are better and certain others that might create more challenges. I think one of the things that would lead me to say we're better positioned is that much has been revealed in terms of the various political agendas and ideological agendas that may have been under the surface but are now very much in our faces. And so I think that gives us important information and data to then begin to think about our approaches to, again, transforming schools in ways that are more equitable and inclusive. Because I think one of the challenges over time has been convincing educators that we are not convincing, but just being able to embrace and accept the fact that we're in a political environment and how that shapes the way that each of us who work within a school community or even at the university engage our work. And so I think the ways that certain individuals who have very strong feelings about CRT not being taught in schools and whatever that represents, because I think it's much more than that particular issue, the way that they have mobilized and unified around that idea provides an opportunity for those who do not support those ideas to kind of come together and figure out what we're going to do.
So thinking more specifically about the needs of Black students in particular, one question policymakers have asked for decades now and continue to struggle with is how do we close racial disparities in student outcomes, both in educational outcomes and in life outcomes? So you founded the Black Education Research Collective, or BERC, housed in Teachers College at Columbia University. So for listeners not familiar with the center, why did you start it and what's its mission?
So I started the Black Education Research Collective in 2017 at TC because I thought it'd be powerful to bring together students, faculty, and practitioners who were really committed to Black education in particular. And we really view Black and Blackness as not only a racial identity, but a cultural identity and a political identity and experience that helps to shape the ways that we think about America. broadly, right? So it's not one particular group necessarily. It is in some aspects, but is what that group represents when we think about the politics of race and the history of race in the United States. I also saw a lot of students who were interested in studying Black teachers, educators, students, and communities more explicitly. And so given the fact that much of that work still remains at the margins, even within equity and justice discourses, you know, I thought it'd be powerful again to unite those individuals so we could share resources, you know, and really begin to pick up the work that has already been laid as foundational by Black scholars in a Black intellectual tradition, and again, figure out what that means in the current context. So as a doctoral student, you know, who was interested in studying school desegregation and Black superintendents, you know, I had a lot of independent research that I had to do. and so a lot of my thinking is making sure that students who are interested don't have to start from scratch, but have a foundation upon which to build so that we can, you know, accelerate, I think, improvements for Black education and educational more broadly.
So you have several major research projects that you're working on, and one that you recently published. So the Burke Report, Black Education in the Wake of the COVID-19 Pandemic and Systemic Racism. So what questions was this report trying to answer? And what approaches did you and your colleagues take to answering these questions?
So, and I'm paraphrasing, but we really had two big exploratory research questions, one of which, how has COVID impacted Black education, you know, given your positionality and perspective? And two, what do you believe education leaders, policymakers, and practitioners need to do to improve it or to improve educational conditions as a result of this moment? So it's very open-ended, and the way that we recruited individuals was to say, you know what, we're using, you know, the academic term culturally sensitive research approach is really drawing from Linda Tillman's work, but wanted to make it really accessible. And part of the recruitment was like, hey, we know that this is a challenging time for Black communities, and we want to hear from you. You know, we want to know how you're doing, and we want to know what you believe the solutions are. You know, given your own expertise. So it was really centering students, teachers, leaders, community members, grandparents, coaches, faith leaders, as the experts in what's happening in community, and not just perpetuating the narrative about how bad COVID and systemic racism was impacting the Black community, but really amplifying those voices so that we weren't, you know, just advancing a generic narrative, but really wanting to hear people tell their own stories from where they were sitting. And so we had a survey that was pretty, an online survey that we distributed. And we also did a series of focus groups in six metropolitan areas, including Atlanta, Georgia, Washington, D.C., New York City, Boston, Detroit, and Las Vegas, Nevada, which is my hometown.
And what did you find?
Well, it was stunning to see the similarities across contexts. So, you know, we know that, you know, context really matters, especially in education, depending on who, from everything from your governor to your legislature to the local school board, whether you're under mayoral control or not, the demographic profile. But to see such similarity across each of those contexts in terms of concern around just the rights, protecting and defending the rights of Black children, you know, showed up quite a bit. The need to ensure that mental health services and support would be provided to students and teachers. So many of our respondents were overwhelmingly Black mothers and educators, and many of them wore the same hat. And so that was a large representation of the sample of individuals that we talked to, and very clear recommendations on what needed to happen. Another was ensuring that we had culturally responsive educators and those who are actually equipped to meet the social, emotional, and academic needs of Black children. Another concern was thinking about the pipeline. And so how are we now thinking about who we're attracting and developing and supporting to become teachers in the future? And then viewing parents and community members as equal partners. So instead of saying, you know, conducting the study and saying, this is what Black parents say they want, how do we really invite and actually allow them to lead and guide us in developing those solutions and how they should be implemented. So nothing new, right? I mean, you could find a lot of this, I think, in the research and scholarship on education, but I think the power of it is that we're centering these voices that often don't get heard, even when, you know, the media is reporting about parent experiences. It's typically white parents.
I think one of the things you mentioned was what parents want in schools and what should be taught in schools. And one of the other projects that Burke is working on is the Black Studies curriculum in New York City. So who's involved in this work? How did it get started? And what are you all trying to accomplish?
Sure. So we're really honored to be a part of the a group of organizations that are advancing the Education Equity Action Plan. So it was funded last fall by the New York City Council. It was part of, it really was the culmination of organizing and activism and policy advocacy among several groups and members of the Black community in New York City. And so the groups that received funding include, in addition to Burke, include the United Way of New York City, the Eagle Academy Foundation, Black Ed Influencers United, and the Association of Black Educators of New York City. And the purpose is to design, develop, and implement an interdisciplinary PK-12 Black Studies curriculum that can be used in New York City's public schools, which serves about 1.1 million students. So we are now entering year two of this work. We were so excited that we received funding to continue it. We'll be running robust pilots, you know, this year in partnership with principals in the DOE to take the curriculum that we did develop last year, which, you know, is a draft, and wanted to really share that, have them engage the lessons with students and teachers and get feedback so we continue to refine it. And then the plan is to pilot those next at the start of next year. And then be ready for full implementation in the fall of 2023.
And it's a little bit different, but I know one of the challenges in California when they were trying to implement their ethnic studies curriculum was going through drafts of the curriculum and then the politics that were involved with different parents that wanted say into what was included. Have you run into any of those challenges at all?
Not yet. I mean, I think it's a little bit different because there are parallel efforts that are happening. So, for example, there will also be an Asian American Pacific Islander curriculum that's being developed. There's also an LGBTQI+ curriculum that's happening. And I believe both of those are piloting this year. There was also prior to this, the Mosaic curriculum that was approved under the prior mayor and administration. And so the new deputy chancellor for teaching and learning has, you know, a lot of exciting work cut out, but it's all happening in a way that I think she is thinking about, and we are in partnership with her, how to bring all of these pieces together to provide, you know, the richest educational experience for all the children in New York City. So not yet, but we are trying to, I think, anticipate the concerns and needs that different groups may have and invite them into the process, right? As opposed to presenting something that, individuals may have a problem with. So again, really using a culturally sensitive approach to incorporate input to limit anyone feeling like they're not included.
And you mentioned that part of your survey work included six metropolitan areas. So is there a possibility that the work that you're doing right now in New York with the Black Studies curriculum could at some point in the future be extended to other parts of the country?
You're on to us, Chris. yes. I mean, part of our thinking, even in entering communities, right? Because for many of us, we were outsiders to some of the communities that we're studying. We tried to really have individuals who had connections to those areas, like, you know, Las Vegas, for me, really serve as entry points. But we recognize the outside nature of us as teachers, college, going into communities. And so we made a commitment that, once we learned what the community wanted by way of recommendations, that we would find ways to also provide, you know, those resources and supports wherever we can. So in every community, they said we need Black history or Black studies as part of our curriculum. And so we see that as something that, you know, we would like to offer, again, in working in collaboration with community, not extracting knowledge from them, but rather working in partnership to begin to implement some of the things that they would like to see happen in schools. So it would be amazing to be able to do this curriculum work and professional learning. I mean, we've talked about curriculum, but professional learning is actually the biggest piece of this in thinking about the long-term strategy for really transforming the teaching of profession.
But in terms of the support that New York City is offering you, what sort of additional supports? You mentioned one, sort of teacher learning. What sort of additional supports do you need or do schools need in order to be able to implement this curriculum successfully?
I mean, it's definitely ensuring that the principal, right, number one, of the school building leader understands and has a sense of the value of doing this work in their school, that they recognize the capacity and the skills and expertise of the teachers they have in their building to be able to do this with fidelity. Black studies is something that very few people have studied themselves, right? Like, if you think about it, I don't have a Black studies degree or background. And so we're asking a lot of people who have been working in schools and those who are aspiring to do that to learn a significant or prepare themselves with a lot of content, as well as a pedagogical approach that's probably very different than what they were trained in. For example, you know, even as we were developing professional development for the teachers, it's like, okay, well, does the traditional PD model, is this even what we want to use in preparing and modeling this for teachers? So it's requiring us to be very reflective and to really, even as the individuals on the project, examine our own knowledge, our self-knowledge, our own cultural backgrounds and biases. And I'm walking us through the scale framework, actually, which is part of this, which includes self-knowledge, culture, agency, right? And so there is a lot of a feeling of feeling oppressed and subjugated in this work, right? And people are very concerned about CRT and the backlash, especially educators. So to answer your question, I think also giving classroom teachers and principals the tools to manage that, the book banning, the reality of confronting parents and community members who don't agree with this. And so there's a lot of support that teachers will need to do this work. And I think making that a priority is critical. And so, again, it's not just about creating these lessons, because even when we piloted them, we found that we can create the lessons, but some of the dialogue that can happen between teachers and students with teachers who may not feel as comfortable with the content can actually potentially do more harm than good. We're really thinking about how we roll this out in a thoughtful way and that people are able to use that knowledge to enhance what they're doing as opposed to create what could be even more challenge in the classroom. So lots of professional learning, doing that for ourselves as a team, and then being able to model that for teachers. And then also recognizing that because Black studies is such, or is an area where a lot of people don't have expertise, that the students are really going to be the leaders in this. So we're actually entering a space where students might know as much or even more, at least about their own culture, than the teachers who are teaching this, right? And so it puts them on, I think, more of an even playing field. And if we let them lead, we could see the liberatory kind of, I think, value of allowing students to lead in this process.
That's amazing. So you meant those are just some of the in-classroom challenges. There's also which you know well, there are the out-of-classroom policy challenges of framing this to policymakers, which I know you're very familiar with. And so when you think about the policy paradigm that we've been in for the last, I would say, maybe 40 years of accountability and standardized testing, and everything has to be aligned with improving student academic outcomes, narrowly defined in that way. How do you see this work shifting the discourse around the outcomes that are important for schools and for students and for teachers and parents and everyone in our community?
We want to emancipate the schools, you know? Again, this is a curricular project, but it requires a complete revolution and transformation of what we're doing. And so we're definitely thinking about assessment and the role that accountability plays, right? So while one strand of the work is developing a curriculum and lessons that align with the scope and sequence of social studies, right, that provides entry points and aligns with the standards, there's also another part of us that recognizes that those standards need to be changed, right? And that the assessments that the teachers are really looking to that shapes what they teach would also need to be changed. So there's a lot of, I think, pieces to this. I think that one of the things that I'm hoping that the education research community does in particular is document the negative impacts of accountability over the last 40 years, right? So there's a lot of promises made that were broken, but I don't know that there's enough of a record of that. And so I think part of this process too, for those who are committed to equity and justice, is to document how damaging high stakes testing, accountability, the expansion of choice without accountability, right? All those things that everyone said was so good. And we see that kind of falling apart, actually, that coalition, right? How do we take advantage of that to then say, hey, you guys had your chance to experiment, it failed. Now we are looking at a more liberatory approach to education centered on values, centering community with our own set of outcomes. And this is the moment where we need to be developing our own theory of change. Educators who are really wanting to, you know, create again this beloved community where it is inclusive, where we value multiple languages and backgrounds, where, you know, you don't have 35 kids in a classroom, but maybe teachers working in teams, teachers are well compensated, the workforce is diverse. I think it's all about creating the mechanisms to create the type of school community and systems that many of us, I think, dream about and work toward, but making that real. And that requires, again, demonstrating and providing evidence of how that other approach and those policies were damaging in a way in order to advocate for the types of policies that we do believe will generate the type of change we want to see.
We're coming towards the end now of our conversation, but so in terms of recommendations, obviously there's still a lot of work to be done to get us where we want to be, to see all kids have the educational opportunities that they deserve. But what is one thing that you think as a community, whether that's policymakers, school leaders, district leaders, students, parents, teachers, that you think we can do now that will lift up historically marginalized and racially minoritized kids?
Great question. I think we need to speak up. You know, I think we need to be louder. I think that the Burke report really outlines what we view as our agenda, which are the recommendations from the study, which is where we're, and it's, again, it's written towards Black students, but I would say it's for all students, particularly students of color, those who've been marginalized, but it's protecting and defending the rights of our children. We are seeing so many egregious acts happening in schools, whether arrests, violence, psychological damage. I mean, you see it on social media and YouTube. So where is the rapid response team, right? When something happens to one of our babies, to say, this is not acceptable and someone's being held accountable. So I think that's number one, showing that we're serious about, you know, protecting kids, because there's no one really there to do that in a way that's important. It's also the mental health, you know, piece. I don't think we are, I think we're so desensitized to the trauma that all of us have gone through. And just being honest and real about that and how damaging it is, especially to developing, you know, to adolescents and those who are still, well, for everyone. I mean, I'm thinking about some adults that we all need some help. But that's real, right? Like, you can't just focus on testing and achievement outcomes and learning loss and completely miss that the fact that our mind, body, spirits, and energies have been and continue to be impacted by fear, anxiety, disinformation, et cetera. Also developing a pipeline of culturally relevant educators. So what are our teacher preparation programs? You know, what do they look like? And how do they need to shift and change and adapt given the new world that we're living in? Where, as Professor Edmund Gordon would say now, and he's 101 years old, he says that teachers would be obsolete in the future, because students have access to any information they want at their fingertips, right? So what we need instead of a teacher is a facilitator, someone who can understand how to work with that student and, based on their interests, guide them and help them to develop their own passions and purpose and interests. And again, engaging partners and community in the process, not at the back end, but in an authentic way. And we say that a lot, but I think we also have to hold the fact that that's messy work. It's difficult. People are difficult. Human beings are complicated. And so going into that work, recognizing the messiness of it, because it all sounds good at first, right? And then you kind of get into these spaces where it can really be challenging. But to know that going in and to having a commitment to working through that so that we can end up with something, again, that centers young people and putting them at the forefront.
So I asked you about one thing we can do, but I'd like to end maybe on a hopeful note. So what's one thing that you see happening right now that sort of gives you hope about accomplishing many of the things that you just described or that you see improving the lives of students and families?
We've got to get in front of the students. I mean, I'm even guilty of this, right? In terms of getting caught up in the minutiae of, not caught up, but my work, you know, requires, it's not as much contact, right, with students. So being really intentional about that, because they have the answers, you know, it's right there. And the question becomes, are we going to listen? And are we going to listen with open ears and recognizing that, you know, I'm not that old, but I grew up in a very different time, right? Like, I have three children. They're 22, 19, and 15. And just even some of the things they do, I'm like, I don't get it, you know, but taking the time to understand it and taking the time to understand their culture and their reality and their hopes and their dreams and their fears. And I feel like that intergenerational piece is going to be really critical, but listening to them and asking them, what should school look like? What do you think you should be learning? What would you like to see in a teacher? Because they tell you, they know what teachers they like, which ones they don't like, which ones are good, which for whatever it's worth. And so I just think that is such an opportunity to really invite them. And that's a way to build relationships with our young people as well. So we are really focused in year two of this project and Burke in general on engaging with children and youth of all ages, hearing what they have to say and the extent to which we can implement that as part of how we move forward.
Thank you, Professor Douglas, for being on this month's podcast. As always, thanks for listening, and we hope you're safe and healthy. And remember that for the latest analysis on education policy, you should subscribe to the NEPC newsletter at nepc.colorado.edu and follow NEPC on Twitter at NEPCTweets.